You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it being Friday, it is Brunch with Bernie time for Senator Bernie Sanders' National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman Program. Bernie will be taking your calls at 866-987-THOM in just a few minutes. Senator, and Senator reelect, congratulations on your electoral victory and welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And Bernie, I understand you won this victory without running a single TV ad. Isn't that a real testimonial to what happens if you tell the truth and you do good retail politics?
Well, all I can say, Tom, is I just want to thank the people of the state of Vermont very much for their very strong support. We got over 70% of the vote, and I did not run any TV ads. We did a little bit of radio last few days. But, you know, we have, during this campaign, what we did is we have held close to 50 town meetings, political town meetings, all over the state of Vermont, including some of the really smallest towns. A town of about 300 people, we had 100 people out to talk at length about the real crises facing this country. And I much prefer to do those type of activities than put ugly 30-second ads on the air. In fact, I've never run a negative ad, but I think I'd rather invest in town meetings, and we had a lot of staff and volunteers knocking on doors, talking to people. In my view, Tom, the future of progressive politics has to do with building a strong grassroots movement, face-to-face discussions, and good meetings where we go over serious issues rather than just 30-second ads. So that's something I believe very strongly. And I just, again, want to thank the people of Vermont and people all over this country who have been so supportive for my candidacy.
Yeah, it really is. It's wonderful that you were reelected and you're back with us. I'm curious your thoughts on the general election, where the Democratic Party, where the nation is going forward from here.
Well, Tom, it was, if we understand that the billionaires, the dozens of billionaires in this country, spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to defeat President Obama and trying to defeat progressive candidates all over this country, you have got to conclude that Tuesday was a very, very good day for working families around this country. Democrats won 25 out of the 33 seats that were up, which is just extraordinary. We elected, not only reelected, some great senators, people like Sherrod Brown, against whom $30 million in Ohio was spent by super PACs. But we elected people like Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, Mazie Hirono in Hawaii. We're going to have good, strong, progressive voices in this coming Congress. So it's not only a victory. We elected some really very good people. We also won some more seats in the House. So I would say that all in all, the American people made it very clear on Election Day that they are not sympathetic to right-wing extremism, that they do not want to see the deficit balanced on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. They want to deal with deficit reduction, but a way that is fair. Obama campaigned on making sure that the wealthiest people in this country begin to pay their fair share of taxes, and that is what the American people confirmed. That's what they want. I think we also saw a rejection of extremism in terms of Citizens United. A couple of states, a couple more states now came on board and saying that we need a constitutional amendment to deal with this horrendous Supreme Court decision, which says that a corporation is a person in terms of campaign spending. And that's a step forward. I think we saw a victory on Tuesday for the understanding that global warming is real. There's some recent studies coming out making the situation very, very dire. And if we don't get our act together and start substantially cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions, moving to sustainable energy, this planet is going to be in very, very serious trouble. Just a report came out talking about very alarming raises in the temperature of the Earth over the next many, many years, and we have got to address that. I would say, Tom, that this election was also a victory for women's rights. A number of women and strong women were elected. And those candidates who had absurd reactionary positions on women's rights were soundly defeated. In some cases, candidates who we thought were going to win, Republican candidates in Indiana and Missouri who were favored to win, women said, excuse me, you're not going to roll back 50 years of gain in this country. We want gender equality. We're not going back to second-class citizenship for women. And that was a huge victory. But having said all of that, and as someone who worked very, very hard for Obama in New Hampshire, where he won a good victory, what we have got to do now is to make sure that the Democrats and the Democratic leadership and the president understand they won and the Republicans lost. And that means that the fight has got to be for progressive politics now and not start making concessions all over the place to the Republicans who lost. And that makes me very nervous. So what we have got to do right now, and I'll be going back to Washington on Tuesday, is to say, yep, we are going to deal with deficit reduction. It's a serious issue, but we're going to remember how we got to where we were. That in 2001, when Clinton left office, we had a $236 billion surplus. Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, his tax breaks for the rich, unpaid for Medicare Part D program, and the lack of revenue coming in because of this Wall Street-caused recession, that's why we have a trillion-dollar deficit. Mm-hmm. That's the reason. And we are not going to cut Social Security, which had nothing to do with the deficit. We're not going to cut benefits for Medicare or Medicaid. But we are going to ask the wealthiest people in this country who are doing phenomenally well at a time when we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. Class warfare has been waged by billionaires against working families in this country. Well, we just had an election, and the billionaires and their lobbyists lost. And now it is absolutely imperative that we move forward in a way that asks the wealthiest people and the largest corporations, one quarter of which are not paying a nickel in federal corporate income taxes, despite the fact they make billions in profits. We are going to address this absurdity of companies and individuals able to stash their money in the Cayman Islands and in Bermuda through these tax havens, avoid paying over $100 billion in taxes to the United States government. And we are going to continue our effort to make sure that everybody in this country has health care as a right. As I mentioned before, we are going to protect women's rights. We're going to address global warming. We're going to make college affordable. We won this election. They didn't. They lost. And the Democrats now have got to get accustomed to the fact that they won, and have got to understand that they are in the driver's seat. And I got to say one other thing, and we're going to be dealing with this very shortly. And we get a lot of calls on this program about this issue, Tom. And that is the issue of filibuster reform. It's an issue that has got to be addressed. The minority cannot determine policy to the majority. Minority deserve their rights. We have to protect those rights. But we need filibuster reform to end the obstructionism that we have seen over the last 4 years.
Yeah, and we're hearing a lot of noises from Harry Reid that he's leaning in that direction. Are we not?
Well, Harry Reid, by the way, just came out the other day. And I spoke to Harry just yesterday evening. Harry came out and said that Social Security should not be part of the deficit reduction discussion because Social Security had nothing to do with that deficit. And Harry is absolutely right. And you're also, he is talking about filibuster reform, which is a very good sign.
All right. Good, good. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. Your calls start right after this break. Stick around. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. You can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov or at tomhartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls for just newly reelected Senator Bernie Sanders. I think of him as America's senator right after this. He's the man, Senator Bernie Sanders, with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your calls. Dustin, listening or watching on our iPhone app in Maryland Heights, Missouri, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. I just watched House Speaker Boehner's press conference, and he, like Paul Ryan before him, is somehow trying to reframe the issue of raising the top marginal tax rate as a general attack on small business owners in general. I know Tom likes to say that figures don't lie, but liars can figures. But what kind of deceptive number crunching are they using here? Who are they counting as small businesses? I'm a small business owner, and I certainly don't make $388,000 a year. Can you help explain this to me?
Yeah, well, I think, Dustin, you're exactly right. They're using a lot of deceptive numbers. And they do that, by the way, if I may say, not only in terms of the top tax rates, they do that in terms of the estate tax as well. What they want to do is repeal the estate tax, which primarily benefits the top 0.3% of Americans, the very wealthiest families. Huge tax breaks for the wealthiest families in this country. I think, Dustin, you're right. What they are trying to do is confuse the American people. What our view is that 98% of the American people, people who earn less than $250,000 a year, should not be asked to pay more in taxes. And we're going to protect the tax breaks for those people. But what we are also going to do is say that when the very wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well, we are going to ask them to pay more. And ironically, by the way, even people who are making more than $250,000, they're also going to get a tax break on their first part of their income below $250,000. They will also get a tax break. But for that income above $250,000, we have a $1 trillion deficit, and they are going to have to pay more in taxes.
Catherine in Los Angeles, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Congratulations, Senator Sanders. And I love your show, Tom. My question is regarding, Prop 37. I was really disappointed that it didn't pass, but it seemed like there was a lot of obstruction of voting in Los Angeles, and I don't know about across California, but I ended up having to vote provisionally because I never received an official ballot in the mail, and all of the neighbors in my building also never received one. So those votes haven't gotten counted, and I guess it's not mandatory for them to count them. So I was just wondering, you know, your take on that.
Well, thank you, Catherine. And I'm actually not familiar with what happened in L.A., but I am familiar with what's happening around the rest of the country. In general, election laws are made at the statewide level, but the federal government certainly has a responsibility also, because members of Congress and members and the president are elected by under those laws as well. I think what I saw on television in terms of Florida and I think other places as well, where people were waiting online for 5, 6, 7 hours, it is so insulting, so outrageous, that in the United States of America, we are looking like a third or a fourth world country in making it extraordinarily difficult for people to participate in the democratic processes guaranteed them by the Constitution of this country. So I think from one end of this country to the other, we're going to have to take a hard look at election law. Here in Vermont, I walked into my polling station, and within 2 minutes, I was out. That's it. You walk in, you get checked in, you vote, and you're out. That should be going on all over this country. I suspect there are many, many people who, when they saw these long lines in Florida and elsewhere, said, you know what, I got a job, I got a kid, I'm not feeling well. I don't want to wait online 3 hours or 5 hours. So we have got to work on that. When people want the vote, they should be able to vote in a timely manner. It should be easier for people to register to vote. It's absurd that in your case you never received that registration. And this is something that we have got to work on. It is a very, very big issue.
Is it Hoden or Hodan in Loganville, Georgia?
Yeah, hi, it's Hoden.
Hoden.
And I've spoken with you before, Tom.
You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
And thank you. Hi, Senator Sanders. My question is, I live in the South. I live in Georgia, and we have had, I'm a very progressive person. My first election that I voted in was Al Gore. And then since then, I've really voted for third parties because my vote really doesn't count, being in a red state. But my question that I have is, I'm really scared that Obama is going to basically do the grand bargain, which I think of as a grand sellout. So what is your, you and other progressives, do you guys have any plans to speak with Obama and to basically convince him not to do it?
Short answer is absolutely yes. We'll be meeting with the majority leader next week. And as I said earlier, and Hoden, thanks very much for raising that issue. And a couple of points need to be made. The Democrats won a major victory. And in fact, they're going to be even stronger next year at the beginning of the next session than they are right now. So I think we have, we are in a position to be determining policy. I do not want to see Democrats caving in. They have done that in the past. So without going into all kinds of details that I shouldn't go into, Houghton, yes, the answer is absolutely. Some of us are working very, very hard on this issue. Just this morning, I was on a conference call with senior groups and veterans organizations, making it very clear in a letter that over 50 veterans and senior groups sent to congressional leaders that we are not going to accept cuts in benefits for Social Security beneficiaries or disabled veterans, which is part of what some of our friends there have in mind. So to answer Hoden's question, she raises a great issue. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that there is not a caving in.
And all of us out here in the hustings, we should be calling our members of Congress and saying the same thing, right, Bernie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. We'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.senate.gov. Check out his website. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, although the good citizens of Vermont, I was one for a decade, I know it well, are very, very proud that he's their senator. They just reelected him. And Matt in East Jordan, Michigan, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, Sirius XM, you are on the air, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, Senator. An article in Business Insider yesterday claimed that they cited both Canadian government officials and officials from the Enbridge company that the Obama administration's approval of the Keystone Pipeline is imminent. Basically, they said it was a done deal. Do you think that's true, Senator, and can the Keystone Pipeline be blocked in the Senate? Thank you.
Well, Matt, I don't know the truth of that story, but this is what I do know. There was a report that was just published just the other day. It was actually in the Washington Post, which talked about scientists now concluding that in terms of their fears and their projections for the rise in the temperature of the planet, they are now looking at the worst-case scenario. In other words, their projections now suggest that the situation is very, very dire. And by the end of this century, we're looking at a 7 or 8 degree increase in the temperature of the Earth, which would be absolutely catastrophic. So I think we should not be, obviously, approving a Keystone pipeline. I think that we have got to move in a very, very aggressive and bold way to cut greenhouse gas emissions, to move away from oil, to move away from coal, and to move to sustainable energy. I mean, we are really now playing with the future of this planet. What we saw a couple of weeks ago, the devastation, terrible devastation that we saw in New Jersey and in New York with Hurricane Sandy, that may be just the beginning of what we're going to be seeing more and more of, and hurricanes that are not only more frequent but more severe. This planet, not only the United States, has got to get its act together and start cutting greenhouse gas emissions, moving away from fossil fuel, and not moving in the way of a Keystone pipeline.
Robin in Champlain, Minnesota, or Champlin, Minnesota. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Hi Tom, and congratulations, Senator Sanders. I heard Representative James Clyburn say today that they plan on raising the Social Security age 2 years, and he has enough votes to cover it, and that way the Republicans will accept taxes. Have you heard anything on that line?
Well, Robin, what I have heard, no, I'm not familiar with what Congressman Clyburn has said, but I am strongly opposed to that. You got a lot of working people in this country who have worked for decade after decade after decade, and they deserve a decent retirement at a reasonable age and not to continue to work beyond the years that they should be working. What I have heard, of course, is that there are a number of different schemes, one of them being raising the retirement age, another one being the so-called chain CPI, which would lower the cost of living adjustments, the COLAs, that seniors and, by the way, disabled veterans receive. So there are a number of different ideas out there on how you can cut Social Security. I am strongly opposed to any of them and all of them because, among other things, Social Security has not contributed one nickel to the deficit and has a $2.7 trillion surplus. Social Security can pay out all benefits owed to eligible Americans for the next 21 years. Our goal is to make sure Social Security is solvent for 75 years, and there are ways to do that. But I am not going to support, and I will vigorously oppose, as chairman of the Defending Social Security Caucus, raising the retirement age for Social Security or cutting benefits.
Okay. John, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and congratulations on your win, Senator. I just wanted to say, you know, I'm just appalled at the voter suppression, and as Tom had said, it is undermining democracy. I don't remember your exact words, but it is, it's just terrible. And I wonder if there is anything proposed, any kind of legislation to standardize voting throughout the country. My 81-year-old father and my 80-year-old mother voted in Florida, and they went from, I think, three precincts down to one, so it increased the time. They had to wait an hour and a half. My mother is quite elderly, sick, rather, and had to sit down, and it was somewhat stressful for them to have to do that when it usually took them about 15 minutes, and the population has not decreased. And I think Florida can afford voting machines, but that's what they did in Hernando County, Florida. And my experience here was, as usual, the last 20 years that I've been here, 15 minutes. And I just am appalled that, you know, they are suppressing the vote. That is the kind of thing that happens in third world countries.
No, John, you're absolutely, let me just jump in and say this, John. You are absolutely right. This is a national disgrace. I think clearly in some cases it is quite intentional. My guess is that the upper middle class voting in suburbs all over America probably did not have to wait 5 hours to vote. They got in and out pretty quickly. But among minority communities, working class communities, low income communities, you have these backup lines. And I think in some cases it is very clear what the goal here was, and that is voter suppression. Make it as difficult as possible for those people who are going to vote against Republicans to participate in the political process. That is an absolute outrage. And you ask me, can anything be done? And the answer is yes. And I think the federal government has got to step in. I don't have the solution right in front of me. But I think we have got to make it very clear that people in America do not wait 5 hours, 3 hours to vote. You know, you go into any large store in this country, you go into a Walmart, you go into a Costco, you don't wait 5 hours to pay your damn bill. You walk in and you walk out. There's a line, they move the line. Democracy is more important than shopping at Walmart and Costco. If they can do it, we can do it. So it is an issue that we have got to address, and no longer can people be forced to wait online hour after hour in order to cast to be part of American democracy?
That is the perfect metaphor or analogy there, Bernie. Lynn Marie in Portland, Oregon, watching. Lynn Marie, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, congratulations, Senator.
Thank you.
I do live out here. You're welcome. I do live out in Oregon, where we have vote by mail. So maybe voter suppression isn't going to be that obvious. But even though I liked your pep talk on being, you know, bigger, stronger, and bolder because we won, but, you know, as of this coming Monday, our one radio channel here, KPOJ, where we get to listen to you guys, Carl Wolfson, Randy Rhodes, Ed Schultz, that's being taken away from us. So no more progressive radio out here, which is almost seems like retaliation for the election by Clear Channel. And I'm just wondering if, even though we won, don't we still need to be on our toes and be alert to dirty tricks and things like that that's going to be continued by the Karl Roves of the world?
Lynn Marie, thank you for the call. I let me just jump in here and say I don't see any evidence that this is a political game that's being played by Clear Channel. But it is happening. KPOJ is going away.
Well, Lynn raises an important point, Tom. And I mean, it touches on a broader issue that some of us in the Senate have tried to deal with. And that is the understanding, you know, that politics and democracy is not just one day every 2 years or every 4 years. It is a very serious problem in this country that we have extreme right-wing talk radio hosts who dominate talk radio in America. Tom, I always forget what you tell me here, but it's well over 90% of talk radio hours are dominated by extreme right-wingers.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Well over that.
So we have some great people. Tom Hartman at the top of the list, Ed Schultz, Randy Rhodes, Stephanie Miller. There's some great folks and many others who are out there doing a great job, but they are outnumbered 9-1, 10-1. And this issue, Lynn, that you're raising, and it's not just a decision being made in Oregon. We have got to figure out a way that the American people can hear on radio and see on television perspectives that are different than Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity. And that's a major, major issue. I think there are states in this country, in the Deep South and elsewhere, where people cannot hear an alternative point of view to right-wing extremism. And therefore, we should not be surprised that kids growing up just hearing that stuff end up adopting that particular philosophy. So this is an issue we have got to work on very, very hard.
And just for the record, to that point, for our listeners in Portland, we do have a web app, Tom Hartman app. There is a Progressive Voices app, which gives all of the people that Bernie just named. That we all have websites. We're all seeing this grow. In fact, the listening, KPOJ had been doing spectacularly well. The ratings actually are up, but in any case, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions in our national town hall meeting. More with Bernie right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions in our national town hall meeting. Steve in Wake Forest, North Carolina, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Tom. Mr. Senator Sanders, I'd like to congratulate on your win in Vermont.
Thank you.
What I'd like to talk about today is the mandate that I see as being apparently, you know, put out there from Americans in this last election that gives Obama and his agenda a way forward. I like to call your viewers, contact their representatives, especially if you're living in a state that voted for Obama. If you have a Republican representative, please contact them and light a fire into them, letting them know that their job is on the line in 2 or 4 years, and that they need to do what we are asking them to do right now and represent us and not their corporate interests. What are your thoughts on the mandate that exists itself
well,
now
Steve,
and on the apparent already Republican denial?
Steve, you said it better than I could. The point that Steve made is absolutely 100% right. Obama won a very strong victory, 3 million more votes in the popular vote. Democrats did extremely well, much better than anyone dreamed possible in the Senate. Democrats won some seats in the House. What Steve is saying is that for us to be successful, all over this country, people have got to start emailing, and it is not just Democratic senators. It is Republican senators and Republican members of the House. You have to say, we do not want to, among other things, see this budget being balanced and deficit reduction taking place on the backs of the elderly, people who are struggling, seniors out there making $14,000, $15,000 a year income. They should not have to take cuts in Social Security when Social Security hasn't added one penny to the deficit. We're going to protect our veterans. We're going to protect our children. We're going to protect working families. In this country today, let me repeat, we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and it is getting worse. Top 1% owns 42% of the wealth. Bottom 60% owns 2.3% of the wealth. That is not only obscene unto itself, it is very bad economics, because you don't get your economy moving. You don't create jobs unless working people are spending money, and today they don't have the money to spend. So Steve's point is right on, and that is, yeah, the election ended on Tuesday. We ought to get back to work right now, and that is get on the phone, get on your computer, and let your members of Congress know that you want them to represent working families and the middle class. Trust me, the billionaires and corporate interests have all of the lobbyists they need down in Washington, D.C. And it's time that Congress started representing the average people in this country and not the very wealthy. And we can make that happen. We can make it happen. If millions of people get on the phone and say, no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, demand that the wealthy and the large corporations stop paying their fair share, end these absurd tax havens, take a hard look at military spending and other issues. We can do deficit reduction in a way that's fair. So, Steve, thank you. You're right. People have got to get to the phone. And by the way, I wanted to mention that now that the campaign is over, we in the Senate office, my Senate office, can start sending out a whole lot of emails. We couldn't do that by Senate rules because of the campaign. Our address is sanders.senate.gov. If people want to hear from us on a regular basis about what's happening in Washington, please go to my website, sanders.senate.gov.
And sign up for the Bernie Buzz.
Absolutely.
For your newsletter. It's a great one. Desmond in Fort Wayne, Indiana. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hey, how you doing, Bob? It's an honor to talk to both of you gentlemen. Congratulations, Senator Sanders, on your victory, and to all of us on a great win for our side this election. I just want to mention to you, Senator, that even out here in Tea Party crazy land, I did get your direct mailer, and I appreciate it. I was able to share that with members of my family, those who haven't been completely brainwashed anyway. And I think it helped make an impact because we did help send a Democrat to the Senate. I think that was very important pickup nationally. And I encourage a lot of other folks maybe to do the same. Let's just say I wasn't surprised that I got the one that I got from you, because you've always been, I think, kind of ahead of the game when it came to preaching truth to power and also to getting that kind of information into the hands of the average American that really needs to see it.
Well, Desmond, thanks very much. And let me congratulate the people of Indiana for standing up to right-wing extremism. What you did was enormously important, and thank you for that.
Okay. Mike in Elmwood Park, Illinois. We have 2 minutes to the end of the show, or the end of this hour, rather. Mike, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call, Mr. Hartman. Senator Sanders, thank you very much, and congratulations. Very quickly, we have two lines drawn in the sand. We have the president's mandate that we're going to increase the taxes very marginally on the top income, and we have the speaker's statement that he will accept no such deal. even though we have, of course, the two out of three, if you will, obviously we can't have 66% of a deal. What mechanisms or what realistic ways do you see that we're going to get past this, or do you think that in the end the Speaker will eventually kind of...
Let me get right to Bernie, Mike, because we've just have 50 seconds left.
Mike, good question. Thanks. Look, the Speaker is in a very difficult position. And the reason for that is that his view is a minority view in America. People absolutely understand that when the rich get richer and their effective tax rate is very low, that they are going to have to help this country in terms of deficit reduction. The Speaker does not have a whole lot of cards to play. Time is on our side. And what we have got to do is stand tall and say to the Speaker that we're going to go to every section of this country, and we're going to ask the people, no matter what state it is, whether they think we should cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, or ask billionaires to pay a little bit more in taxes. And you know what, Steve? You know what, Mike? On that issue, we have overwhelming support. So we're going to win this fight. Democrats have got to remain strong and tough.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. We are going to be giving away a copy of my book, Cracking the Code, which documents the history of the modern both conservative and liberal movements, starting with Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, back in the 1600s all the way to today. One of my favorite books, Cracking the Code, that I've written. At some point today, Shano is going to say that caller and whoever it is going to get an autographed copy in the mail, courtesy of stamps.com, by the way. So also, I mentioned yesterday that Sunday, Louise and I were married on November 11th at 11:11 a.m., which is also when the armistice was signed back after World War I at 11:11 a.m. on 11:11. And so Sunday is our wedding anniversary, and I mentioned it yesterday and said, you know, a couple of people had contacted me and said, you know, what can, you know, we'd like to send a card or a gift or something. What do we do? And I said, please go to huntersschool.org and make a donation. The fact of the matter is that by coincidence that morning, I had been on a board meeting call, and the school is in part, actually, just a couple of students from areas that have been hit badly by the hurricane, their school districts are just, you know, they can't pay their bills right now, and so it's like, you know, the school is running tight, and so I wanted to thank the people who contributed yesterday, Ronald, Cynthia, Jean, Susan, Howard, Jean, Lynn, Zoila, Russell, Rich, Lynn, maybe that page got printed twice, Andrew, Michael, Peter, copies of all these, Lori Ferris and Jim Kemmerer, who run the program, sent me copies, gifts, from $20 to one person gave $1,000. Thank you so much. And we're actually about now a third of the way toward the goal, what the school needs. So I would say today, if you are inclined, this is a great charity, hunterschool.org, and they could use some help right now. And if you want to do it as an anniversary gift to Louise and I, it's much appreciated. So put that on the table, and after that, it's Anything Goes Friday. But Senator Sanders is no longer with us, but I'm still here, I think this kind of is emblematic of, you know, Wall Street titans and one percenters and how they think. There was a small story on NBC. Garrett Hake reported this, that after Mitt Romney conceded, his staffers around the country got in cabs to go home and tried to pay their bills with their Romney campaign credit card. Now, the Romney campaign is still alive. I mean, campaigns live for months, in some cases years after the candidacy, and has a lot of money, which can be used for other purposes. But these aides discovered, well, I'll quote from Garrett Hake at NBC News, aides taking cabs home late that night got rude awakenings when they found the credit cards linked to the campaign no longer worked. Like, thanks for your service, buddy. Out. This is the Bain way, right? Hey, you're toast. So, anyhow. Robert. Well, that's interesting. I just flipped a priority here. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. A week and a half ago, if one of the candidates would have showed real compassion, hugged those people that lost their homes, floods, and their cars being messed up, the Electoral College may have been different. So, that's basically my stance. And please, let's not forget them and donate to the Red Cross.
Yeah. Well, you know, Obama not only won the Electoral College, he won a huge majority in the national popular vote. In fact, in five out of the last six presidential elections, and six presidential elections at 4 years each would be over the last 24 years. Five out of those six ones, the majority of the votes has been won by a Democrat. There have been a couple of occasions when Republicans have taken office, but always by a Democrat. And so I think that that's an important point, that it's time for us to say goodbye to the Electoral College. The Electoral College is an archaic anachronism. It was put into place to protect slavery. Seriously, that's why it was there. Plain and simple. There was a lot of flowery language around it, but that's basically what it was all about, was to, you know, at the demand of the slave states. And the Electoral College needs to go. And we do need some sort of rational national voting system. So, Rachel in Newport, Oregon. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, don't you think the better strategy would be to let these Bush tax cuts expire, and then if the president wants to give some of them back, he could do so piecemeal in exchange for a jobs bill? And by the way, they've had these tax cuts for 12 years. The supposed job creators haven't created any jobs.
Right. I agree. And in fact, I've been saying on this program for some time, and I will continue to say that I believe that the best strategy, and thank you, Rachel, for the call, I believe that the best strategy for the Democrats right now is to say no. You know, we're not going to play games. We're not going to go namby-pamby. We're not going to go piecemeal. No, we're going to let the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year. And this is what essentially President Obama is saying. He came out today and said, well, actually, I've got the audio here. This via BBC News. But if you can bring up my computer, let me just set a reasonable gain level here. This is the president speaking today.
But as I've said before, we can't just cut our way to prosperity. If we're serious about reducing the deficit, we have to combine spending cuts with revenue. And that means asking the wealthiest Americans to pay a little more in taxes. That's how we did it.
And the majority of Americans like that. That's why it's an applause line. It's just the billionaires who fund the Republicans don't like it.
That's how we did it in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president. That's how we can reduce the deficit while still making the investments we need to build a strong middle class and a strong economy.
There you go. So President Obama speaking today, saying basically, yeah, we're, the rich are going to pay a little more. So here's the problem the Republicans find themselves in, and here's the solution for them. Virtually every Republican in the House of Representatives, and I believe all of the Republicans in the Senate, have signed a pledge to a multimillionaire lobbyist who lives here in Washington, D.C., where I assume he lives in or near Washington, D.C. His offices are right down the street here on K Street, a multimillionaire lobbyist by the name of Grover Norquist. I don't know Grover well. I've met him a number of times. He's been on this program a number of times. He used to come on and debate me back before he became such a big shot. And Grover's pledge was that they would never raise taxes. And these Republicans have sworn to this lobbyist, to Grover, that they will never vote for legislation to raise taxes. And back in 1993, when President Clinton put forward a proposal, the 3% tax increase on the really rich, all of them, all of the Republicans in the House, all of the Republicans in the Senate voted no. Fortunately, both the House and the Senate at that time were controlled by the Democrats. So it passed, and it handed off such a surplus to George W. Bush when Bill Clinton left office that George W. Bush's State of the Union speech was in part about how he was going to use that money that Bill Clinton had given him as a result of that 3% tax hike on the rich to pay off all of the national debt, believe it or not. So my advice to the Democrats and what I think they're going to do is let the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year. Let us go off the fiscal cliff. Don't panic about it. And then the first week of January, come in and say, okay, now taxes are back where they were when Bill Clinton was president. We're not asking you Republicans to raise taxes. We're asking you to cut taxes on the middle class and ignore the top end. And I think the Republicans might be able to go along with that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
At least then they can say to Grover, you know, we didn't actually raise taxes on anybody. That tax cut just expired, and we are cutting taxes on the middle class.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. James in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering if anyone had talked to you, whether it was Bernie or whoever, about the possibility of working with some of the more libertarian-minded Republicans, like Rand Paul or even Paul Ryan mentioned that he would be in favor of letting the states decide their own policy on marijuana. And anyway, getting together and maybe drafting a letter or doing something that basically pushed the Obama administration and Attorney General Holder into leaving Colorado alone and the other California and the other states.
I think that what we're seeing right now, James, is a tipping point. Back, you know, in 54 with Brown versus Board of Education, and then the busing that came in the late 50s and early 60s out of that, and the confrontations with Lester Maddox and George Wallace in the early 60s, all of that stuff basically those were the last gasps of the dying apartheid in the United States, of the death of apartheid in the United States. I mean, I remember when I was a kid. This was in the 1960s, early 1960s. I was a teenager. The girl next door to me, we lived in a white neighborhood, and the girl next door to me was white, and she wanted to marry a black man, an African American, and her father was so opposed to this that he would not go to the wedding with her. He would not give her away at the wedding, is the phrase. And so she came over to our house and asked my dad if he would do that. And my dad walked our next door neighbor's daughter down the aisle at that wedding with her African American husband. And my father was proud to do it. My father, the Republican. And the family next door never spoke to us again. I mean, that was kind of the end of that relationship. Other than the daughter who was friends for years and years. But the point is that was a period in time when kind of America was kind of torn apart by anti-miscegenation laws, you know, interracial marriage and things like that. I think on two issues right now, we are at a very similar point as we were with racial issues in the 60s. And those two issues are the rights of gays and gay marriage in the United States and the Nixon's war on drugs, and not just pot, but in general, the whole general insanity of prohibition as a way of dealing with what is a medical issue, not a, you know, it shouldn't be a criminal issue. And so I don't know how it's going to play out. But I believe that you're right. Your suggestion that, you know, the libertarians on the right who believe in personal liberty with regard to at least things like, you know, pot and prostitution. Prostitution, I don't think, has hit a tipping point yet in the United States, but there's not loud advocates for it, but other than libertarians. But with regard to pot, both people on the left and people on the right saying, yeah, let's get together and do this. And I think it's going to happen. I think that it's a done deal. How it's going to happen, I'm not sure, James, but I, you know, the times are ripe, and you just saw it in your state there. And in fact, I'm guessing that, you know, a lot of the people who voted to decriminalize pot also voted for Mitt Romney. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, I voted Libertarian. I voted for Gary Johnson.
He's right of Mitt Romney, and you're voting to decriminalize pot. So, point made.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I mean, I'm pretty left on a lot of issues. But I think this is the kind of issue that, frankly, while Obama, I mean, they've been decent on it. They really have kind of let us kind of run a little wild in Colorado. They've mm-hmm. respected the state laws to a large degree. My problem is that Obama, his rhetoric, whenever he talks about it, he's pretty dismissive of the whole thing.
Yeah,
and he doesn't really acknowledge
he's
going to
have to
issue.
He's going to have to change that the same way that, you know, the Eisenhower administration, the last couple of years of the Eisenhower administration, Dwight really wasn't around that much. He'd had a pretty bad heart attack, and I think it was 58, and Richard Nixon was doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the last year or two of the Eisenhower administration. But you know, he didn't talk that much about race in public. Jack Kennedy started talking about that. I think that, and Lyndon Johnson, of course, you know, brought in all this legislation, but it was really Kennedy's legacy. But I think that President Obama stands at a historic moment. And James, thank you for the call. I think he stands at one of those crossroads moments where, particularly with people like yourself, young people who think that libertarian is cool, don't really understand the economics of it, frankly, no offense, but, you know, sometime call and we'll debate economics. I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, because libertarian economics are even worse than Republican economics. But in any case, young people who think that being libertarian is cool, or they've read Ayn Rand because, you know, their school got a bunch of free copies courtesy of the Koch brothers, that's a group that the president really should have, the Democrats should have, and Democrats, you know. And the third issue that I think is ripe, that the times are very ripe for right now, is international trade. This whole idea that free trade, you know, even exists. There's no such thing as free trade. Every country trades in ways that work to its benefit. And we did from 1789 up until, you know, basically the Reagan administration. And this was the big debate that I had yesterday or the day before yesterday with a libertarian, with a guy from you know, one of the libertarian groups here on this program. And he was saying, you know, hey, yeah, we don't need no stinking borders. Just throw the whole world open. Let every American worker compete with somebody in China or in Africa or fill in the blank who's willing to work for 25 cents an hour. And that's not historically how nations work. So I think that I think the first party as a party that says we're in favor of decriminalizing pot and ending the war on drugs, ending the militarization of our police that has been associated with it, ending the war on drugs, and turning that whole issue into a medical issue rather than a police issue, thus breaking the backs of the drug cartels. They're in favor of doing that, ending the war on drugs, in favor of saying gay people should have full civil rights just like everybody else, period, full stop. And number three, saying it's time to re-embrace protectionism, what built this country, and what is building China right now. You think the Chinese are not protectionist? You're crazy. This is how they're being successful. It's the Indians, they're in India, they're very protectionist. It's how they're successful. The Germans, very protectionist. The Japanese, insanely protectionist. The Taiwanese, Singapore, the list goes on, the countries that are doing well because they're protecting their manufacturing industry. We need to do those three things. And the party that does that is going to start winning elections like crazy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Those are three of the 11 things, by the way, listed in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, about how to rebuild America. We'll be right back.
All right. Express yourself.
Yeah, it's Anything Goes Friday. You can express yourself. General Petraeus, by the way, apparently expressing himself a little too much. It's sad. He's resigned from the head of the CIA today, citing an affair, an extramarital affair. I'm not sure why that would cause you to not be eligible to be the head of the CIA if you're out about it. I mean, you could be blackmailed if you were trying to hide it, but if you come out and say, you know, whatever explanation he's going to give or just admission and then just go on. But it was it Jacques Chirac or I think it was Who was the French president before him? The famous guy who made it through World War II. I'm forgetting my French presidents, but in any case, I'm pretty sure that it was Jacques Chirac at the funeral of, maybe it was Charles de Gaulle. Charles de Gaulle is the guy I'm thinking of. It had to have been more recent than that to have been de Gaulle's. Mitterrand. At his funeral, he stood there with his one hand in his wife's hand and the other hand in his mistress's hand. I mean, the president, you know, of France. I think America, and this is, you know, I'm not pro-affair or anything like that. I think America is a little too parochial. Or Petraeus is using this as an excuse to boogie out of the CIA, which is frankly my opinion. Because I don't think, you know, I don't think an affair. I mean, David Vitter got busted with a hooker, you know. United States senator, access to all the security information, whatnot, got busted with a hooker, which is a crime, by the way. Having an affair is not a crime in most states anymore. And Vitter comes back, and the Republicans in the Senate gave him a standing ovation. He got reelected. So, I think this is Petraeus moving on, but who knows. I'm no expert, but that's the big news of the day. The other thing that I find interesting, Occupy Wall Street is doing this thing, the Rolling Jubilee. There is this industry, this debt collection industry. It's one of the fastest growing industries in the United States right now. And hospitals in particular, it's mostly medical debt, but it's also banks, credit card debt, housing debt. You can buy debt for pennies on the dollar. There's a marketplace for debt. You could go out and buy $10,000 worth of debt for $300. Seriously. And what you get is the name of the debtor and copies of the bills. And, you know, here's Joe Schmo and here's his phone number. And basically hospitals and other groups, they sell this debt to these collection agencies when they figure that it's going to cost more to collect than they'll ever get. And so you buy $10,000 worth of debt for $300. And then you just harass these people to death until maybe you get back $4,000 or $5,000, you settle on it and you make a profit. That's how the debt collection industry works. So there's an Occupy group that just went out with $500 in cash and bought $14,000 worth of debt and then called up the people who owed the money and said, we are forgiving your debt. It's a jubilee, right? The jubilee in the Bible was, you know, every 7 years you would leave your crops fallow. Every seventh year a field would not, you know, it would just go to weeds. This is how they would recover. This is how you have sustainable agriculture. And then every 7 times 7 years, every 49 years, the year after that, the 50th year, every 50th year, all debts are erased. All wealth is redistributed. The rich become equal. The poor become equal. The slaves are freed. Everything reboots, the entire society. This is in the Bible. This is how Israeli or Hebrew or Jewish society, whatever it was called at that time, way back in the day, sustained itself for millennia. And the Occupy movement's doing this. They're going out and they're buying debt, pennies on the dollar, and just forgiving it. I would love to, you know, if they put up a website where you can go in and put $25 in, something like that, you know, I think so many of us, I would be pleased to kick in $25 or $50 or $100. Towards buying somebody's debt. You know, $100 would buy, you know, $5,000-$6,000 worth of debt. And you could just forgive it. Some total stranger, but it's like, here we are, all in this together. I think this is just one of the coolest things happening right now. So, as of this moment, David Reese is the organizer who's been putting this thing together. And they're calling it the Rolling Jubilee. Like, let me check out their website here. There's a link to the website. I can tell you what it is. It's rollingjubilee.org, and they are taking money. Okay, cool. So, I probably should have waited until Monday to say this because I'd like you to donate to hunterschool.org in memory of Louise and my, not memory is the wrong phrase, but, you know, celebration of Louise and my anniversary this weekend, this Sunday, our 40th wedding anniversary. But, you know, this is also cool, rollingjubilee.org. Janet in Gustine, California. Am I saying that right, Janet?
Yes, you are.
Hey, what's on your mind?
And I think that's a wonderful idea previously. Yeah. I'm not going to talk about anything serious, really. But you were talking about your cat, Higgins.
Yes.
And what that cat suffered the other day.
Yeah, he grew up in a, just to recap very quickly, and then back to you for people who don't know what we're talking about. Our son rescued this cat from this frat house. This was a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago. And it had been a feral kitten who, I believe, as I recall, they raised it with a pit bull and locked it in the bathroom for days. And this cat survived by drinking water dripping out of the shower head. And to this day, if you open a bathroom door around on our boat, we've got a shower. And Higgins, you know, will be sitting there in the shower with his mouth open waiting for the drips. I mean, today, right, 13 years later. And he lived on pizza and potato chips. And I can't order pizza, or if Louise makes a pizza, or if we bring potato chips, you know, onto the boat or into our house historically, you have to defend yourself. And they also used to throw Higgins against the wall because he would misbehave. They'd literally throw him against the wall. And when we first got him, we had to lock him in a bedroom and only go in when we were wearing leather gloves because he would come flying across the room through the air trying to take us out. And it took about 6 months to reach the point where we could handle him without leather gloves on. So back to you.
Yeah, you couldn't wean him off the pizza. I was wondering if that was
that never happened.
Good thing for him.
That never happened. In fact, we had pizza last weekend, and Higgins just sat next to me on the, you know, he's got some manners now. He sat on the floor next to me, just going meow, 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 meow all the time. And so I'm breaking off pieces of pizza and feeding it to, there you go, and feeding it to him as I'm eating pizza. But yeah, that's my cat.
Now I'll tell you about a cat. At least I think it was a cat when it came up my steps. Mm-hmm. I opened the front door, and he was the most disreputable-looking creature. And he only had one eye. He was blind in one eye.
Uh-huh.
He had one ear with a kind of chevron chunk taken out of it.
Yep.
And his fur was like wire. He's all black and with one yellow eye.
Huh.
And I felt sorry for the poor thing. I'm not a cat person. I'm a dog person. But the cat, I fed him. He seems to be a little old, but and of course he was all black. And he seems to be, you know, on in years because there seem to be a little bit white mixed with the black in his fur.
He's getting gray.
And so I kept him and I fed him. I didn't know how much to feed him, but maybe about a cup of food, maybe half a cup in the morning and half a cup in the evening. I didn't know. I don't know cats, so I didn't know how to feed him even.
Right.
I just bought the cheapest cat food I could find called Alley Cat.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you, about a month ago, that cat has turned into the most beautiful animal.
Yeah.
His fur, it got soft and, you know, and it didn't look wiry. And, but, you know, I think he's an older cat. He just does not want to hunt for himself.
Yeah, it sounds like an old feral cat that finally decided to come in and become a domesticated cat. That is great, Janet. And thank you for sharing that story. And thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. What it tells is the story, really, Janet's story. You know, we humans share with all other mammals this thing called the limbic brain. It's called the limbic because it's kind of shaped like a dog leg, like a limb. It's where the word actually originated back in, you know, what, the 15th century or something when they were doing brain anatomy. And the limbic brain is where we process emotions. Fish, amphibians, alligators, crocodiles, snakes, they don't have a limbic brain. They have fight or flight responses. They have protection of young responses. Some of them, some will eat their young fish in particular. But they don't have the range of emotional capability that we do. But your cat, your dog, and I've had dogs literally from the time I was born until about, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, Sabra, our dog, died at 19 or 20 years old. She was quite elderly. Cats, dogs, cows, pigs, you name it, they all have limbic brains, and they all experience emotions the same way humans do. It's one of the reasons, frankly, over the years, I stopped eating meat originally as a statement against the Vietnam War, as a statement of pacifism. And the more I learned about, you know, the suffering that animals experience in slaughterhouses, and these are beings who share the same limbic brain with us. Now, our cortex, our thinking brain, is much more developed. It's much more elaborate. But that limbic brain is not that different. And so the emotional range of an animal, and the, you know, if you've ever owned a pet, you know, the emotional range of an animal is not all that different from the emotional range of a human being. We may have a lot of fancy words to describe it, but, you know, there it is. So, thanks, Janet, for sharing your story. We'll be back. 45 minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You got to feel sorry for these staffers on the Romney campaign who found their credit cards canceled in the middle of the night as they were trying to get home from the... They couldn't even pay the cab fare.
Every time I read the news, I'm always more confused.
Well, let's check in on the news. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So other than David Petraeus having an affair and stepping down from the CIA, do you really think he's stepping down because of the affair, or do you think that that's just the excuse?
I think he may be stepping down because the affair was about to become public.
Uh-huh.
Not because he was having an affair. If he was having an affair, he was suddenly having a massive attack of conscience. And I don't find that married men very often have massive attacks of conscience myself.
Okay.
I suspect that the affair was about to become public and he was about to get busted.
But even if he was going to get busted, I mean, David Vitter got busted with a hooker and he got a standing ovation from his Republican colleagues when he came back to the
Yeah,
Senate.
But this is the spy agency. This is the agency by which, in theory, you can be blackmailed.
Yeah, okay.
And he's got to set the example for all those spies in countries where they can't take that risk.
Well, that makes sense. That actually makes a lot of sense.
I think that's why.
Yeah. So what else is going on in the world?
The Supreme Court said today, 3 days after the election, that they will hear a constitutional challenge to the part of the landmark Voting Rights Act that requires all or parts of 16 states with a history of discrimination in voting to get federal approval before making any changes in the way they hold elections.
Whoa, so the Voting Rights Act could be struck down by 5 right-wing wackadoodles on the Supreme Court?
That is one way you could look at that.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
It's an appeal from Shelby County, Alabama, near Birmingham, which says state and local governments covered by the law have made significant progress and should no longer be forced to live under oversight from Washington. Now, the High Court did consider the same issue 3 years ago, but sidestepped what Chief Justice John Roberts called a difficult constitutional question.
And that question was?
This issue.
Whether the federal government can insert itself into the electoral affairs of a state.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what they're going to look at is whether the formula under which states are covered is outdated because it relies on data that's now 40 years old.
Hmm.
And by some measures, states covered by the law are outperforming some that were not.
So one possible outcome would be that they'd say, yeah, this law is fine. It no longer applies to Alabama, but it does now apply to Ohio.
Right.
That would be interesting. I doubt, John Roberts would have anything to do with that, but that would be interesting. So what else is up?
People are saying that they need to update the data and deal with it that way.
Yeah.
Also today in the East Room, the president gave his first public remark since he won re-election, surrounded by an applauding public, which is interesting that he chose to do this rather than have a press conference with the Washington Press Corps, and a sign perhaps that he's decided to govern in this second term more towards the people and less towards Washington, just something that struck me.
Which would be a very healthy thing, I think.
Interesting.
He would be tearing a page out of Harry Truman's playbook.
Yeah. Well, he also said in a reflective interview some months ago that one of his mistakes in the first term was not speaking more directly to the people.
Mm.
He said he would open discussions with congressional leaders next week. He invited people to the White House to seek a compromise, and he defended what he called the detailed plan he campaigned on, including higher taxes on the wealthy. He said, I'm not wedded to every detail of my plan. I am open to compromise. I'm open to new ideas, but I refuse to accept any approach that isn't balanced. We have to combine spending cuts with revenue, and that means asking the wealthiest Americans to pay a little more in taxes.
Now, I understand he called both John Boehner, the leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, and Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate Republicans. And both of them, whoever answered the phone for both of them, told the President of the United States that they were asleep and could not be awakened. I'm not making this up. Is that an accurate?
John Boehner went to bed at 11:15 on Tuesday night.
11:15 Tuesday night. Both of them were asleep and could not be awakened. And have they ever returned the president's phone call, either of these men?
Well, they have spoken. John Boehner cited a cordial conversation with the president on the morning after the election.
So after he had a good night's sleep.
Yeah, no, he has spoken. And John Boehner is a deal maker.
But the problem is he's got Eric Cantor standing there with a shiv in his hand, you know, standing right behind him with that with a little pointy tip of it stuck in his kidney.
And it's not just him. He's got many more behind him.
Yeah. Yeah. Daryl Issa and the whole crew. I mean, he's got the whole Tea Party, band of crazies behind him. It's enough to drive a man to drink, make him cry.
Well, and smoke.
Indeed. Yeah. No, yes, nicotine. We need drugs.
Yes.
Oh, my.
All of the above.
Okay. So what else is up, Victoria? We have a moment.
Also today, serious news. 11,000 Syrians have fled to neighboring countries in the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
9,000 of them to Turkey alone because of the civil war.
Yeah, this situation seems to be coming to a head, and it's not good. There, a very good piece in the New York Times today about how disheartened average Syrians are with the opposition, because the opposition in many cases has been as brutal as the regime.
Yep.
And it's like, how do you fight evil without becoming evil? It's one of the great challenges, and they appear not to have pulled that off.
Very few people have managed to achieve that. Mostly they've been individual men and not groups of men who don't seem to get that right.
Yep. Agreed. And agreed on the gender-specific part of it, too. I think, you know.
Yeah, it does seem to be. Also today, the Pentagon has released a timeline of the military response to Libya, showing that the first U.S. military unit arrived in Libya more than 14 hours after the attack on the consulate in Benghazi was over, showing how far the military response lagged behind the attack, due largely to the long distances the commando teams had to travel to get to Libya.
Okay. Thank you for that. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. It's our Anything Goes Friday here. And so, your thoughts, my thoughts, the news of the day. General Petraeus getting it on. No, he's getting it out. He's out of the CIA. Ed in Choctaw, Oklahoma. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, good talking to you. And happy anniversary, by the way.
Thank you, very kind.
I'm a 100% disabled Vietnam vet, so I've been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to get your take on is, in most other professions, such as securities and the medical field and the legal field, if you do something drastically bad, you can be barred for life from ever being involved in that profession again. Mm-hmm. Why can't we do that with politicians that do things like ISA did?
Because to restrict Well, you know, the First Amendment says that, you know, free speech is there, and you know, restricting political activity is the very, very last thing that should ever be done in the United States if we believe in a free body politic. Somebody wants to elect somebody who's been convicted of a crime to office, you know, and that happens, and it has happened with some regularity over the years in the United States. Unless people vote, as we did here in Washington, D.C., it was actually a ballot measure to say if somebody is convicted of a felony, they no longer can serve in office. Unless there's a specific law to that effect, unless the people came up with that law, then you know. So if by what ISA did, you're talking about his publishing the names of CIA operatives in Benghazi and in Libya.
Exactly.
Putting their lives at risk.
That's a security violation. It's a violation of his oath of office.
I think so. I am of the opinion that Daryl Issa should be investigated for that. He should also be investigated. I mean, CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, Siri W. Melanie Sloan's organization, has two requests to Congress for ethics investigations into Daryl Issa. One for that, for outing operatives working with the CIA in Benghazi and in Libya. And the second, which probably led to their death and that of their families. And the second for this more recent thing that Daryl Issa did, where he produced a little video and put it up on YouTube using government money, using his office in the House of Representatives, using government money, produced a video basically trashing the State Department for spending money on meals. And, you know, this is not his purview. And it was basically an anti-Obama piece. And he released it just before the election. This was just, you know, pure electoral politics, nonsense. So Ed, I'm with you. I think that, you know, we should be holding him to account. Boyd in Franklin, Ohio. Hey, Boyd, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, it's a pleasure talking to you. I'm a long-time listener and a first-time caller, and I just wanted to wish you a happy anniversary. As today is my anniversary.
Oh, that's great. Well, happy anniversary to you, too.
Thank you. You touched on the Electoral College, and my dad and I have talked about this. He was he's a retired school teacher,
mm-hmm.
30-plus years of educating and driving a school bus and what have you. Doesn't there need to be an amendment to the Constitution to remove that or restrict it Would the popular vote take over what the Electoral College is doing now?
The popular vote would, and there's a movement called National Popular Vote. I'm pretty sure their website is nationalpopularvote.org. And we have either 7 or 9 states that have signed on to this. And it can be done without amending the U.S. Constitution. It can be done by the states because the Constitution basically gives electoral powers to the states. You know, they can run the elections the way they want. They could determine who their senators are going to be however they wanted. They can determine who their electors for the president are going to be. And so without blowing up the Electoral College, but simply rendering it irrelevant, what the states who have signed on to this National Popular Vote thing say is that if a candidate for president of the United States has received a majority of the national popular vote, then they will pledge their electors to that candidate. Now, that's let me see if I can get the exact language, because it's actually far more sophisticated and fancy than that. And
okay.
popularvote.org, I think this is it, and that's not it. So let me just Google National Popular Vote, because I want to get the language for you, it's nationalpopularvote.com, and here it says that the bill preserves the Electoral College while ensuring that every vote in every state will matter. It's been enacted by states possessing 132 electoral votes, 49% of the 270 electoral votes needed to activate it. So far, Vermont, Maryland, Washington, Illinois, New Jersey, D.C., Massachusetts, California, and Hawaii have signed on to this thing. And let me see if I can just explanation. Here it is right here on their website. Under the U.S. Constitution, this is their description. Under the national popular vote bill, all of the state's electoral votes would be awarded to the presidential candidate who receives the most popular votes in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. This would only take effect when enacted in identical form by states possessing a majority of the electoral votes. So when you've got enough states that represent 270 votes, those states then pledge all of their electoral votes to whoever gets the majority in the national election, which would have to be counted first. And because a state can cast their electors for anybody they want, or they can direct their electors to vote for anybody they want. And so this would do that. And so far, all the states that have signed on for it have been Democratic states, have been blue states. And it's probably going to stay that way for a while, because the Republicans, just like the old slave states, are using the Electoral College to protect their minority status and to give them outsized power relative to their minority status. It used to be that the slaveholders were, you know, minorities in their states compared to the slave populations that they had. And you know, now it's the corporate CEOs. Minority status relative to the workers. So, Boyd, that's how you do it, and you can check it out at nationalpopularvote.com. Thanks a lot for the call. Raul in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Hey, Raul. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, Tom. Those people who were working for Romney's campaign, they were baned. You know what I mean?
They were baned. But, you're exactly right. We need to turn that into a verb to be canceled in the middle of the night.
Yeah, you would have thought Romney would have had a few extra bicycles, you know, laying around, at least for the his staffers, you know.
Yeah.
But did somebody say that Del Issa was an oaf of legislature?
Yeah. He was a what?
Recently. The oaf of oaf. Legislation or oaf, you know, as in
OAF?
Buffoon.
No. Yes. No, I think we were talking about his oath of office, OATH.
Well, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
But anyway, Tom, you know, you brought up about 3 weeks ago when Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. It should have decreased the need for slaves, but it did the opposite, because cotton became more valuable, land became more valuable, and it had to be acquired, and also slaves became more in demand. They had to actually re-import them, you know, illegally. But because of the cotton gin, it made the cotton more valuable.
Now, if a cotton gin could do the work of 50 slaves, how did it make slaves more valuable?
You had to have more land to grow the cotton, so you needed more slaves.
Oh, I see. So this was thus the push for the Missouri Compromise, the push to move out west to expand. I get it. Okay. Roel, thank you for that. I need to do a little more research on that and get a little better understanding of the dynamics of that time. The era of the Civil War is not one that I am as familiar with as the Revolutionary War. Although I do want to go see Lincoln this weekend. Louise and I are going to go see it. We'll report back on Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour, anything goes Friday. Your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day. Stick around. Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. David in Seattle listening to Talk 1090. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, I got two questions for you.
Mm.
One is, whatever happened to Dylan Radigan, the talk show host on MSNBC?
I don't have a clue.
And then the other question is, what are the chances that Don Siegelman will be pardoned?
I think that if they have, as I recall, we had Dana Siegelman on a week or so ago. She gave the number. It was something like 50,000 people had signed the petition. They were trying to get 100,000 or whatever it was. They were like kind of halfway to their goal. And I really think that there is a tipping point where if enough people sign on to this thing, sign this petition, it's free-don.org is the website, or donsiegelman.org, that there's a very real possibility that President Obama will pardon this guy. This Don Siegelman is in jail because because he offended Karl Rove, basically. He was sent to jail for something that is, if it's a crime, then President Obama should be in jail too. He appointed somebody to an unpaid position who had not given him a penny, but supported the lottery to pay for schools in Alabama that the governor supported. And this was a guy who he appointed to this hospital board who had served on that board under three previous governors, two of them Republicans. He had been reappointed over and over and over again, and Don Siegelman simply reappointed him again. And, you know, Karl Rove's best friend came in, and his wife prosecuted Don Siegelman. And Siegelman, of course, had won the election in 2002 to be governor. But Bob Riley, his opponent, his campaign was being run by the federal prosecutor's husband, Karl Rove's best friend, Mr. Canary. And in the middle of the night, after the election had already been called for Don Siegelman, in the middle of the night, in one Republican area, after the Democratic poll watchers had left, they discovered 13,000 or 15,000 votes and flipped the election over to Bob Riley. And when Don Siegelman started yelling about it, this vote got stolen from me, that's when they started prosecuting him, and in a big way. And this was one of the Bush political prosecutions. Dana Siegelman has, you know, talked about this at some length. Don Siegelman has been on this program dozens of times talking about this, and it's pretty irrefutable. So go to free-don.org or donsiegelman.org and sign up. This is he is a political prisoner in the United States, and it's just wrong. Dana in Silt, Colorado. Hey, Dana, what's up?
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Thank you.
If you're not a doctor of the political science, you should be teaching at Harvard or Yale.
Your
knowledge of political history is amazing. I watch your show every day.
Well, thank you. So what's up?
I have two issues to address. One is semi-humorous. One is I heard on NPR, I listened to NPR, Amy Goodman, and you.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard on NPR one morning going to work, and I'm an ex-postal worker that was ripped off through what happened with the retirement thing.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, for every dollar invested by K Street, by the lobbyists, they get 17,000% return.
$17,000 back for every dollar they put in. That doesn't surprise me. That's probably about right. It is
the most profitable
business in America right now is investing in lobbyists. There's no doubt about
that. That's right. It's a travesty. I woke up Wednesday morning with hope for this country.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I wonder if those 14 seditionists that met in the restaurant the night of Barack's inaugural address are going to meet again to limit him to a second term.
Well, you could, if you happen to be represented by one of these people, you could call them and ask. It's Congressman Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, and then Senators Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. Those are the people, the 14 people who met.
All through the campaign, none of this was ever mentioned. Only one time, Al Sharpton on MSNBC started to bring that up, and he was cut off.
Yep. Yeah, it's. I think outside of talk radio, people talk about it and they go, "Oh, it's a conspiracy theory." And
right.
You know, no, it's not a conspiracy theory. Robert Draper wrote a book about it called "Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives," and Draper is a world class historian. And this is not a political hit job. He's simply telling the history of the House of Representatives over the last decade, and this is a very significant part of it. That's 14 members of Congress, of the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, got together and basically swore an oath to each other that they would do everything they could to obstruct President Obama from saving the economy. And this in order to make him a one-term president and destroy the reputation of the Democrats. And this at a time when we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. The Dow had fallen from 12,000 down to 6,000. The entire world's credit markets were frozen up. We were staring down the throat of another Great Depression. Henry Paulson had been standing in front of the White House with his hands trembling, begging for two different TARP bailouts, both of which the Republicans voted for. All 14 of these guys voted for to give when George Bush was president. And as soon as Barack Obama comes in, no, not a penny, not a friggin' penny. So, I'm with you. We'll see. So give them a call if they represent you. Thank you for the call. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. We have a minute to the break. Michael, what's up?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman? Okay, I'll make it quick, unfortunately.
First off,
congrats on your 40th with Luis and yourself.
Thank you.
Actually, I would like to go into, since it's Anything Goes Friday, robotics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of your former callers called in about the cotton gin. That was sort of like one of the first robots.
Mm-hmm.
How bad could it get
if corporations like Foxconn and all these other corporations, if they just don't hire people anymore, but they start buying robots, which don't need lunch breaks, don't need vacation breaks. I'm just curious what you would think.
It could create the leisure society, Michael. The reality is that the 40-hour work week was made possible by mechanization. If it wasn't for the Industrial Revolution, it would be a 50, 60, 70, 80-hour work week like it used to be. And in the 1960s, I think it was in 1967, Time magazine did a cover story on this about how by the year 2000, productivity would have increased to the point where the average person would make the same salary they were making in 67, but would be working a 28-hour week. And because, you know, the robots would be taking over so much of the work, so we'd have much more leisure time. And had corporate America not redistributed that money up to the top and offshored those jobs, that's actually where we would be right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, you know, some serious reevaluation of our industrial processes and systems is in order, and our tax policy, in large part, is what has driven the death of the middle class. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And anything goes Friday, whatever you'd like to talk about. I've got my list. Are we ever going to hold these guys responsible? Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker, the Republicans, members of Congress of the House and Senate who met together on the night, January 20th, 2009, the night that President Obama was inaugurated, met at the Caucus Room restaurant here in Washington, D.C., and plotted to make him a one-term president by blocking, obstructing any effort on his part to have successful legislation that would save the U.S. economy? Are they ever going to be held accountable? I generally don't know. I also don't know why more people are not talking about this, frankly. It seems to me like a BFD. But Naima, if I'm saying that right, in Atlanta?
Excellent. You said it very well.
Thank you.
Congratulations for your anniversary.
Well, thank you.
And for the good work that you do.
Thank you.
I know that you spoke briefly about rollingjubilee.org for credit card debt.
I did.
I'm a retired school teacher who was foolish enough to co-sign for my son's education. Mm-hmm. And I retired because of health reasons. And now we are in some serious situation. He has graduated with no possibility of getting employed up till this point. And we are constantly being harassed with the Sallie Mae Student Loan Corporation. And so I know you mentioned about rollingjubilee.org for credit card debt, but please let the listeners know that student loan debt exceeds credit card debt in this country.
Yes.
And please, whatever you can say to give me some information,
well,
I appreciate it.
My strongest point, and Naima, thank you, very, very well said, is we have $1 trillion in student loan debt out. You're correct. It slightly exceeds credit card debt in the United States right now for the first time in history. I mean, it's the first time we've ever had students in debt like this. We had free colleges, you know, for most of the history, much of the history of the United States, for students who qualified, you know, who intellectually had the capability of going to college. And we should again. But Ronald Reagan put us on this course when he ended the free University of California system and as governor of California and then came into the federal office and just, you know, he'd kicked this thing off and it went nationwide. Today, the federal and state and local governments cover about 20% of the cost of college educations nationwide. In the 1960s, they covered 80% of them. And that's, I mean, that, so who made that up? Students and their parents like you and like me. I mean, you know, I signed for one of my kids' student debt. Fortunately, she has a job right now. But, this is a real tough one. And this is why I keep saying we should have something like a national service program where people, after they leave high school, they put a year in, whether it's in the military or volunteering in hospitals or volunteering in schools, some service to their country. And then in exchange for that, they get at least 4 years of college education for free. We did this with the GI Bill. People came back from World War II. My dad came back from World War II. My wife's father came back from World War II. My dad was in the Army. Her dad, Louise's dad, was in the Navy. And they both went to college on the GI Bill. My dad, after 2 years, dropped out because Mom got pregnant with me. But her father, Louise's father, continued and got his JD, became an attorney, first in his family ever to graduate from college, and ended up the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. And all because we gave free college education. I mean, this is... And my dad was on track to become a history professor. That's what he wanted to do. Although, like I said, Mom got pregnant with me, and that kind of changed his trajectory of his life. But we really need another GI Bill, and I don't think it needs to be associated with our having had a war. And I'm with you. We need to do something. Thank you for the call. And thanks for raising the issue. It is an important one. It is a vital one. And unfortunately, I don't have a solution for you and your family and the situation that you're in, other than to call relentlessly, monthly, to call your member of the House of Representatives, your two senators, your local senator, and I mean your state senator and your state member of the House of Representatives, the governor's office, the White House comment line. Just keep pounding on these people that, you know, this is not the American way to have people go broke. It's not the American way. Paul in Springfield, Virginia. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Very well.
You know, one of the things that I noticed a lot during the presidential campaign was this back and forth discussion on energy independence. Obviously, the Republicans weren't talking that much about green energy. But when you look at the history of this country in World War II, when we wanted to create an atomic bomb, we took all these brilliant scientists and put them in one place and said, do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1960s, when we said we want to go to the moon, we took all our most brilliant people and put them in one place and we did it.
Yep.
Why are we not looking at a Manhattan Project style something to take this country to true energy independence and off of fossil fuels?
The reason we're not is because there is a small handful of corporations that are the most profitable corporations on Earth who own assets greater than any other corporations on Earth, with the possible exception of the banks, who I have basically bought most of the politicians here in Washington, D.C. You know, Bernie Sanders, you heard him on the program in the first hour of our show go off on how important it is that we end our dependence on fossil fuels, that global warming is real, that the projections now look like it's actually going to come out worse than the worst case scenarios, or at least in line with the worst case scenarios, that middle ground or that best case that we were hoping for. Looks like we've blown that, and we need to do something about it. I'm with you. I absolutely agree with you that we need to have a Manhattan Project commitment of some sort to this issue.
I mean, if we did something like that, I mean, it could benefit industry. It could benefit jobs.
It would be
a
tremendous thing.
Unlimited.
It would be a tremendous thing. And with just a small tweaking of our trade laws so that we kept the outcome of that here in the United States. I mean, you know, we invented transistors and integrated circuits, but, you know, they're all made in China, Japan, Taiwan. You know, shouldn't be. Should be that we should be the manufacturing floor. We used to make apples here in the United States, you know, Apple computers. Now we don't. And it's all because of our trade policies. So, A, yes, let's develop these new technologies. And then, B, when we start manufacturing them here, let's keep them here. Let's keep those jobs here. Let's keep that manufacturing industry here. I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. Rick in Dublin, California. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Let me put you on my – sorry.
Take us off speakerphone. Okay? Yeah, if you take us off speakerphone, it'll sound better.
Let me get you off speakerphone. Sorry, let me get you right off here. Okay.
Gotcha. Hi,
okay.
Tom. Tom, hi.
Yes.
I'm a
so what's up,
listener.
Rick?
Okay,
Thank you.
We have a new short film I wanted to mention to your viewers. It's about the continuing economic inequality in America, and it's set against the backdrop of the Occupy movement, particularly the incident in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Noam Chomsky appears as himself in the film. It's his first non-documentary film, and both Occupy.com, Crooks and Liars, and other progressive groups have linked to our site.
Great.
And I'd like to give you the website.
Okay.
It's the99percentmovie.com.
Okay, great. And I would encourage you, Rick, also to go over to tomhartman.com and post that on today's blog, on the blog for the day, and
okay.
You know, it'll get more people to it. Thank you. Good luck with that. It sounds like a great project. Les in Park City, Utah. Hey, Les, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Two-part question. Number one on health care, and as they call it now, which President Obama has embraced Obamacare. And number two on the taxes that are going to go. I work with a bunch of guys that make over $250,000 a year, and I've been hearing them go on about how, oh, my accountant claims that after 2012, I'm going to be paying an extra $2,000 a month. So kind of basically, are we going to see people in that tax bracket a large increase, just a mandatory across the board increase in our taxes? I'm not sure where.
Not to the best of my knowledge. The only tax increases associated with Obamacare that I know of are kind of around the fringes. For example, there's a slight tax increase on tobacco products that goes to help fund Obamacare, which makes perfect sense because you got, you know, 450,000 people a year in the United States who die because they smoke cigarettes. Half a million people a year die because they smoke cigarettes. So it's reasonable that part of that cigarette tax should go to cover the cost of treating those people who are dying because they were smoking, number one. And number two, if you have a capital gain, not ordinary income, if the guys that you're working with are making their money with capital gains, if they're basically stockbrokers or run something like Bain Capital, if they're banksters, if you have a capital gain that's over $250,000, then your capital gains tax will go from 15% to 18.3%. So there will be a 3.3% increase in your capital gains tax after the first $250,000, and that goes to pay for Obamacare. And to the best of my knowledge, that's it.
Okay. No, we work for a paycheck. I'm a pilot.
Then what you're going to see is probably your health care costs going down. Because as states come up, in about half the states in the union, you can only pick from one or two health insurance companies. And because they have monopolies, they have basically stranglehold power over prices. Once states put into place these exchanges, or if states refuse to and the federal government comes in and puts into place these exchanges, you're going to have much more competitive marketplaces. Also, under Obamacare, and this just kicked in a few months ago, the health insurance companies cannot take more than 20% and skim it off the top and use it to pay their CEOs. Used to be they were taking 25, 30, 35, 40%. Now they're limited to 20%. Les, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, Anything Goes Friday. We're going to be giving away a copy of Cracking the Code, one of my favorite books, The History of Progressivism by Tom Hartman.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our call screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, Sirius XM, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks of Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to J. Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It means a lot. It really does. Steve in River Forest, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to get your opinion as to why there seems to be so little discussion about, amongst Democrats and those who are friendly to democracy, journalists and pundits, about upgrading our voting system to something more mathematically sophisticated like instant runoff or board account.
Yeah, I think that the reason that it hasn't happened is because both political parties oppose it. It would crack open the duopoly, the control over the political system that these two parties have, and would make third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh parties viable. And so you're not going to hear most partisan politicians talking about this kind of thing. You will hear somebody like Senator Sanders endorsing instant runoff voting. He's an independent. He's not a member of a political party. But
What would you say to Democrats in order to convince them that it's a good idea for them?
Well, that it's good for democracy. I mean, if you really believe in your country and if you really believe that the Democratic Party has good principles and people are going to be behind it, you shouldn't be afraid of competition. You shouldn't be afraid that the Green Party might also be on the ballot. And in fact, I think it would make the Democratic Party and frankly the Republican Party as well, if the Libertarians are on the ballot, it would make them more honest brokers of the political discourse. So, unfortunately, the party that has been pushing this is just all by themselves. It's the Green Party, and they've pretty much been, the lone singers of this song out there. And we need more. If you want the Democratic Party to push it, then show up at your local Democratic Party headquarters and say, "I'd like to become a precinct committee person," and then you can help write the ballot, the platform, the plank of the platform about instant runoff voting. And if enough people inside the Democratic Party started pushing for it, then maybe it would happen. Steve, thank you for the call. Todd in Anoka, Minnesota, listening on AM 950 in Minneapolis. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wondered if you caught the article by Dana Milbank in the Washington Post where he compared the two different election night parties, Obama's and Romney's.
I did. Obama invited tens of thousands of people. Romney invited several hundred people. Romney's was, coat, tie, ladies in evening dresses and cocktails and waiters and, serving fancy food. And Obama was like, party down with the people. Yeah, I've read it.
Yeah, restricted access. Press had to pay $1,000 to get in a certain area of Romney's. There were, like you said, waiters serving canapes and fine meals to those on the finance committee at Romney's party, and of course Obama's just wide open to the people. I thought that was a really interesting contrast.
Todd Shane says, "Go ahead, finish your thought."
I was just going to say he tried to pretend to be something, the man of all 100%, after he got caught in Boca Raton, and the truth came out that night.
Yeah, absolutely, and just like with Reagan, I mean, Reagan ran as a man of the people, and then his first inaugural ball was, such a departure from what Jimmy Carter had done before, where Carter had walked down Pennsylvania Avenue with the people. Reagan, it was all limousines and fancy and expensive and the whole thing. Todd Shane says, you are going to receive a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. I'm putting you on hold. Todd is on line 4. Just FYI, let us know so that we can get your address information. And via stamps.com, we will send you an autographed copy. Max in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Max, thanks for listening to 1350, AM 1350 there. What's up?
Yes, I was a poll worker for early voting here in Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an incident that we had that, made me real feel good as an American. It was during our lunch period when we had 3 people of our 11 on lunch break, and we were just swamped with all kinds of voters. And we had one voter who just stepped forward and started directing people to the stations where we were checking them in on the computers. And I looked over to one of the other workers and I asked, did the county send someone down to help? And she just stood there for about 10, 15 minutes directing people to the different stations. And then when the line went down to nothing, she just stepped forward and voted herself and went on her way.
Hmm.
And it really made me feel good that she just stepped forward and took charge and,
Yeah. Yeah, that is good. That's a marvelous story. Max, thanks for sharing that. Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Victor, we have a minute to the end of the show. Your thoughts?
Yes, hi, Tom, and happy anniversary, too.
Thank you. Please go to hutterschool.org to celebrate with us.
Okay.
So what's up?
Listen, I wanted to say, yes, as far as air cannon and all that, I feel there should be some kind of financial terrorism bill written or something like that.
Well, I think that, an ethics charge against these guys at the very least is appropriate. I personally think they should be impeached for this kind of behavior, but I'm not sure that it's impeachable. It may be, but I doubt it. I mean, this was a partisan decision, and partisan decisions are made all the time.
Grover Norquist also should be that kind of thing, too?
Well, Grover wasn't in the meeting. Newt Gingrich was in the meeting, and Frank Luntz was in the meeting. And interestingly, Newt is going to be a guest on this program on Monday. We will ask him about it. That should be interesting. Victor, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Have a great weekend. If you get a chance to get over to hunterschool.org and you want to say happy anniversary, celebrate Louise my anniversary with us by making a small donation to the Hunter School, it'd be much appreciated. And don't forget, democracy begins with you when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. I'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.